Brought to you by WorldWrestlingInsanity.com.
Good job, guys. You found part two of JG's Radio Free Insanity for Friday, February the 17th, 2006. We're about to be joined on the phone line by Kevin Kelly. As we said before, former co-host of WWE Raw, former WWE announcer, a big part of the company during some of their better years. You mean there were better years than the ones we're in now? Better years than this one. So let's bring him on. He'll talk a little bit about it. Guys, let's get him on the phone line. All right, guys. So join me in welcoming to the show Kevin Kelly. Kevin, what's going on, man?
Nothing. Man, I'm a huge fan of your writing.
Really?
I really enjoy the website. I just your take on everything, the artwork, the whole deal. It really entertains me.
Did I?
I've wanted to be a part of the show for a while. I've begged, I've pleaded, I've sent money, and I guess finally the hookers and prostitutes I sent to you finally got through.
Well, they were good. I did send some of the diseased ones back to you, just for, you know, obvious reasons. But,
you know, that's it just goes to show you, you can't do things for people anymore. Leave it to somebody like you to complain about a diseased hooker.
It definitely made Valentine's Day a little more interesting, although a bit itchy, but still interesting nonetheless, man.
It's red.
What's that?
Just look, it's red, honey.
That's the idea right there, man.
Let me know when the interview starts for real, and we'll really start. We'll start talking about wrestling then, right?
Oh, yeah, when the interview begins, we'll do it up. Well, the way things usually work on the show, we have a couple of avenues that we take. We can bitch about John Laurinaitis, which is always a big favorite around here. Or we could talk about some of the things that are going on in wrestling. You're still watching the product, right?
I tried.
Mm-hmm.
I was against it for a long time, where I would only just sort of periodically glance at Raw. TNA moved to Spike TV, started watching that a little bit. I keep up with that now.
Okay.
I know what's going on. I was really into SmackDown because I'm a big fan of Taz and Michael Cole.
Okay.
I like them personally, I like what they do, and they always make me laugh. But the whole thing with Eddie Guerrero and exploiting his death, I said, you know what? This is why I didn't watch the product, so I'm back boycotting SmackDown again.
Oh, no, well, I mean, it's bizarre in some ways, the way they're kind of playing it out. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that have been in WWE, like yourself, and one of the main things that I do hear a lot are people wondering, who's actually watching the product now? Who are they booking this towards, and who's enjoying it, if anybody?
I don't know, because, look at, Vince always wants to be Hollywood. He wants to be sports. He wants to be Entertainment Tonight. He wants to be a little bit of everything, which is fine. But at least do one thing well.
Mm.
If you want to do comedy, there are a lot of different styles of comedy. You could be slapstick. You could be dry humor. You could be, Lost in Translation, to me, was a very funny movie. But so was Wedding Crashers.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Different levels.
Be funny. And if you want to do news, do news well. If you want to do drama well. They don't do anything well, so what they wind up being is nothing.
It's like a little bit everything.
It's very frustrating.
I mean, it's just gotten to the point where it's almost like it seems that they want to kind of shove everything into the same show. Case in point, I think the big thing was last week, Mama Benjamin had a heart attack on Raw. And she's been this comedic character to the point where she forgot her own last name on her first pay-per-view appearance. So it's always been kind of treated with this kind of joking atmosphere. Then they do an angle where she has a heart attack, and you got Joey Styles crying over it. Like it's this huge, massive deal. And then to make it even worse, right afterwards, they forget all about it. It just seems that they go in and out of genres without really fully accepting anything.
The show is flawed.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the idea of the camera being a voyeur,
yeah.
If the camera allows the viewer to be a voyeur, then you cannot have live commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the live commentary should be, if you liken it to the Greek tragedy, the commentator should be like the Greek chorus.
Yeah.
Which is flawed because the Greek chorus would tell the audience what was going on. you were never, the chorus was always separated from the actors.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have that. And the idea that the monitors are present backstage, which they use, so it just doesn't make any sense. And so what they always wind up doing is appealing to the lowest common denominator, and they always wind up giving everybody some kind of flaw, malady, or sexual proclivity to the bizarre. Mm. It just, I don't understand it.
Well, I mean, I'm actually glad you brought that up, because it's almost like a slippery slope theory that happens with WWE, I've noticed. They start off doing something slowly, and the next thing you know, they're going balls to the wall every 10 seconds. One of the big things was, like, case in point, like, with your character, when you were doing the thing with The Rock, and you were one of the original commentators to kind of get goofed on by The Rock, and now it almost seems like everybody backstage that does an interview gets goofed on. By the same token, they have that with the cameras. Originally, years ago, I mean, it wasn't, if the camera picked something up, it wasn't ignored by the other wrestlers. They knew it was on TV. It was treated as if the cameraman was there. And then they introduced GTV, which was supposed to be this insight into parts of the arena where cameras weren't supposed to be. So that was kind of the explanation. And then over time, they just got rid of GTV and just changed logic altogether. And now the cameras see it, but no one acknowledges it. I don't know if you had a chance to hear about Raw yet. We're actually filming, taping this before Raw airs, but there was a segment last night on Monday Night Raw where Trish Stratus, his boyfriend, came in to confront Mickey James, and Mickey James tried to kiss him and then started screaming that he tried to rape her. The next segment, Trish was believing her as if it wasn't just all filmed and put on TV. It was one of the strangest things ever, and the announcers knew what was going on, too. It made no sense.
And again, the idea of the camera just being an inactive participant backstage was all part of the crash TV era, which I'm sure you've heard that term.
Oh, yeah.
Where it would crash, literally, the shot would jump from the ring to something backstage to which the announcers were completely caught off guard. Now, if you have this frantic, maniacal pace, you never have time to inform a Trish Stratus
mm-hmm.
of what the truth is. However, the idea that they take time to replay things that just happened flies completely in the face of the crash TV theory. It doesn't work.
Oh, yeah.
2 hours on a Monday night, folks, we don't have time to tell everybody what's going on. We're just catching our breath and hoping to keep up with the pace, and we hope you keep up with us as well. And then, you know, at 11:05, everybody exhales.
Mm-hmm.
But now, since they want to make sure that everything has meaning and this, that, and the other thing, they replay, you know, what just happened ad nauseum, and it loses its effect because it's not shock value. It's not crash TV. It's watered down because you're not supposed to digest it. It's supposed to be just quick hit there and gone, and what was that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you were a big part of that breakout period, the whole Crash TV era in the late 90s, and things seemed to be, I would say better, but better, and it was kind of like they were getting better ratings, they were getting more mainstream attention. What is your personal opinion about really set that time apart from the other things, and what is wrestling missing now that it had back then?
Well, there are four main elements that are missing right now, and that's The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Mick Foley, and Vince Russo. Mm. And those four elements were consistent participants in one of the most original eras ever. They had great characters with incredible depth, the three did, and Vince Russo was able to steer Vince McMahon away from his long-held belief in his tried-and-true network of yes-men who were, who were sort of kind of continuing status quo with what had built the company up in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost depressing in a way. I mean, because you look back on that time, and it's almost like WWE keeps trying to pretend that it's either cycles or something else, but in reality, you can really watch a show from that time period and watch a show now and see a huge change in the crowd reaction and how WWE almost presented their own logic.
It is a byproduct, and Jim Cornette always said this, that every period of hotshotting in the territory where things would be done just for that shock value to pop a house to do whatever, every period of hotshotting would be followed by an equal or longer period of drought or downturn.
Oh, man.
You have to figure that for 7 years, the company hotshotted every week.
Oh, dude. It's so funny that you bring up that quote, because I think I've quoted it somewhere or another, but I remember reading it, and it's the kind of thing that I haven't really come across ever since, and the fact that you brought that up, I remember thinking that in the late 90s, that it was kind of, something like that would be cynicism, and wow, and because you kind of live in that bubble, and it's never going to end, and it's always going to be great, you know, wrestling on TV, and Nitro, and Raw, and everything ruled, and you never really thought that that was a possibility, but, you know, holy shit, I mean, it really came full circle in that respect.
It really did, and I try not to look at the business in a negative light, because there are so many young fans who are missing, who weren't a part of that era, and can watch the DVDs and can relive it on video on demand and things like that. The advantages that we didn't have, I mean, we were just in the infancy of the DVD era.
Yep.
Coming out of Coliseum Video and then WWE, WWF, then producing their own DVD, it was great. And we just look back at that time and remember it fondly. I mean, there'll be something that comes along that may not equal it, because, I mean, that was the single hottest period in wrestling's history in terms of a national scale. Certain territories had done monster business over periods of years. But when you talk about pay-per-view dollars, merchandise dollars, live event dollars, salaries that were made, the company going public in the XFL, and you know, the entire Monday Night War saga, it's going to be hard-pressed to ever find another era that will ever top that again. But I'm sure something will come along. Somebody will come along that will captivate the imagination of wrestling fans and will make them forget about, you know, the business being in the lull right now.
I mean, it's funny, because we just said before about kind of living in that bubble and how it never gets better. Just like you're saying now, it almost feels like we've been in this bubble for so long, this kind of Triple H bubble of the new school WWE, that it's hard to imagine reaching that point again, you know?
Well, it won't happen until things change.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, you know, Rock brought to the table, I always felt, was a bit of an isolationist in a way. He insulated himself from the H effect, and did not allow, despite all of his best efforts, didn't allow Hunter, which I'm sure you document very well in the book, and I'm looking forward to reading.
Thanks, man. There's a plug.
There's a cheap plug. But it, you know, Rock was able to isolate himself from the H effect, and Austin was strong enough and enough of his own man to not give into it as well. Mick Foley was a victim of it, in his own way, but found other ways to be successful. And since then, nobody has not come along strong enough, resilient enough to be able to stand up to that and make a name for themselves because of it.
Let me ask you this about Rocky, because, I mean, you're bringing up The Rock, and you worked a lot with him, so you saw a lot of kind of what he did. His career now, and it's almost funny, because in a way, he kind of got away from it all. You know, I mean, he was WWE, but even now with his career kind of settling down in Hollywood, not like red hot, it's still almost a part of me that doesn't want to see him come back in the current environment they have. And I don't even know, do you think if they were to find a guy like Rock now, with WWE's current political climate, he'd be able to reach the level that he did then?
Rock was unique because he had the third generation background. Mm-hmm. He was smart to the wrestling business before he ever got in, and I don't know of anybody else out there outside of, I mean, I'll just pick a name out of it, just Harry Smith, for example.
Okay.
Because of his family lineage, he might be smart enough to know, you know, not to get all caught up in those games and be strong enough to be able to play his own version of politics when time is needed. Mm-hmm. But will he have the same crossover appeal and the just pure magnetism and personality that The Rock had? Really, the combination of being older in the business than his years, the fact that he was such a good-looking, charismatic guy, really just put him on another level instantly. And again, prevented him from being torn down or brought down to a certain level.
Mm. Yeah, because what I'm trying to really get at is the fact that back then, with a guy like The Rock on the card or Steve Austin on the card, the whole show was structured almost differently. I mean, there weren't too many family ties yet. Shane and Stephanie hadn't really debuted on television until around 99, around that time, as real characters in wrestling. And almost to the point that back then, all the characters had storylines. There was a reason to watch the show, even if you weren't a fan of the top-tier guys. Nowadays, the way the card is kind of structured, it's all about the main event. And then there's some other little stories that they'll follow. Maybe some will get a pop, and some will get noticed, some will get ignored and forgotten about. How do you think it's that much harder nowadays to be able to reach a level where you'll be able to connect with the fans and get your character over because there's no spots available to really get the characters shining on TV in their own way outside the main event?
It is funny because you think with two different shows, two distinct brands, mm-hmm. that you would have plenty of time to be able to achieve that.
Yep.
But in effect, by dividing the brands in half, you cut the television time in half. Now, instead of giving WWE superstars 4 hours a week to get over, you give half the roster 2 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, remove Heat and all the syndicated shows. So really, it is focused just on those 2 hours that particular brand does get. It's tough with commercial time, with sponsorship time, with the need to replay things ad nauseum. You really do get focused on just the top two or three guys. Now, seems, you know, on the other side of the coin, to me, there are not a lot of top guys that are ready or deserve that level of play. One thing about Rock and Austin and Mick and Ken Shamrock and the list was on and on and on. Those guys were damn good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they had the ability to go out there and turn it on and light a fire under the crowd, make things happen. You know, and you had Owen and you had Davey and you had, you know, Sean for a little bit and Brett for a little bit of that. And you had all the other sidebar characters, you know, the development of the Brood, and you had the all the guys that were involved in the ministry, and then the undercard guys, you know, the Steve Blackmans and the Al Snows telling the hardcore story. You had more depth than you have now. Everybody is sort of bland, cookie cutter, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as well. It's a homogenized roster more so than ever before. Without a lack of, you know, the lack of divergent characters, you wind up with sameness, and sameness breeds sameness. What's different about one segment than the next?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with what you're saying. In that respect, I think that one of the things that a lot of fans have been bringing up is the fact that marching now on this road to WrestleMania that we're all on, this is one of the more underwhelming roads to WrestleMania as I can remember in a while.
The last one that was really like this, with the product being in the malaise that it was WrestleMania 13.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And that was around the time when, you know what, it was time to start doing things differently. That was the time in which, you know, the WWF was drawing its lowest ratings on Raw, and Vince Russo was starting to have a hand in the writing, and things were beginning to change and turn around. The roster needed to flip and turn over, and new stars needed to be developed. But you also, at the same time, you had competition in WCW that kind of fueled that along. I do believe that there is a bit of an air of invincibility in Stanford because there are no other, you know, there's no other windmills to fight. And I think that they believe they'll sell whatever, they'll buy whatever we're selling them.
Yeah.
Where it used to be the people will buy only what they want to buy. And when that philosophy changed, I guess when WCW was bought and, you know, the war was over, that philosophy, I think, is leading to some of the problems of today. I mean, you can't just point to one thing, James.
Yeah.
It's a lot of things. And from the corporate structure, when the company went public, a lot of things changed. It became less of a family-run business and more of a corporation. It became more about, you know, who was doing what as opposed to what was being accomplished. I mean, I never ran around tipping my hat for anything that I did, but I had my hand in a lot of little stuff. It was great, though, because I felt like I was a part of a great team of people. You know, when Vince Russo was writing the magazine, he was being pulled in 10 different directions. to write TV, to help out with creative, to come up with merchandise, to do all kinds of different things. So he put me in charge of the magazine so that he could help do some more of that. And in turn, we were able to turn out some really good magazines, and because I was there to help him with the magazines, he was able to create good television, which led to better magazines, and so on and so on. And at the whole time, we, you know, there was an open line of communication to Vince, and we could submit ideas, and we could just have fun and get together and brainstorm and come up with some cool ideas. And that was one of the things that led to that era being so cool.
Well, what happened? I mean, in your opinion, what happened? What made it go from, I mean, because this is a story that a lot of people tell. They say that, you know, in that time period, Vince was, you know, accessible, and people had hands in things, and they were all into it. And nowadays, you listen to the locker room, and it's like listening to the WCW locker room. People, you know, they want to hang themselves, you know, from the Titantron. What exactly is it that changed, and did you notice it? At what point did you see a change?
It started to change after, oh, I'd say probably 2000, 2001.
Okay.
And, I mean, really, the business changed for the WWF when, you know, the night after WrestleMania 18, when Rock went to Hollywood, they turned Austin heel.
Mm-hmm.
Their top two baby faces were done, gone, see ya. And there was no going back. Now, Austin needed to turn heel, but Austin needed to turn heel a year before.
Yeah.
And they needed to have a heel Austin versus Rock headlining that main event at WrestleMania. But it didn't happen because of Steve's neck injury. So what you wound up with was the turn happening, leading to the two-man power trip, and then at the same time the invasion angle comes in. And nothing happens with that because Vince was never going to allow those guys to get over on his guys.
Yep.
And so now what do you got? And at the same time you go with the brand extension, you separate, you divide, you cut it in half, and you know, let's expand the audience by cutting it in half. I never understood that theory. but again, that's the decision that they went with. And then adding another layer of vice presidentia in the business, another line of corporate people who don't know wrestling, who don't have any history or knowledge of the business, and no interest in knowing anything about the business. And there was always sort of an air, especially at the TV studio, of an anti-wrestling community, and I don't hold that against those people because they were not wrestling people; they were television people who produced a wrestling show.
Mm-hmm.
But when you added that next layer, especially over at the tower, now you took out all the wrestling people, as Pat and Bruce got more. You know, Pat Patterson, Bruce Prichard got more away from the product. You started to phase out some of the older guys, you know, in the accounting and the office there, and you know, in the live events, and you start to really change the business, the corporate structure. That led to kind of the change of atmosphere. That now, along with the rise of Stephanie and the rise of Hunter, makes people want to hang themselves from the Titan truck.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's just, it's funny because it all kind of came out at the same time, and it almost feels like, and I've talked about this before, and it's hard to find too many people that agree with me, but it comes down to Vince always had that competition with WCW, and it was almost like when that was gone, he was trying to start competitions with fans for what they wanted or with what people wanted from the shows. It would almost be like for a good period around 2002, he was giving people the opposite of what they wanted or what they expected.
Almost in spite of the audience.
Uh-huh.
I always felt that. Let's take somebody that they'll like, a Rob Van Dam,
yep,
and not give it to them. And there's an idea, because I think the way it's sold to Vince a lot of times is, well, we don't want to rush it. We want to get there. We don't want to just put it all on him tomorrow, because then where will we go?
Yeah.
But of course, the idea, especially with that coming from Hunter, is, well, Vince, I really don't ever want him to get to that level, but I don't want to tell you that, so I'll sell you the line, well, we don't want to give it to him all today, because where will we go with him tomorrow?
Exactly.
And then, you know, they'll just conveniently forget to get back to that level, and by that point, it's too late, because you've already beaten him down. Well, we can't do it with him now, Vince. He's not a top guy. Look at him.
Mm-hmm. He has flaws.
Oh, and they've done that when guys have... And I don't know how the decision was ever made to put the Undisputed title on Jericho. It was a good decision at the time, and again, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Hunter was still out with the quad injury.
Yep.
There wasn't really anybody else to go to. Rock, Austin, okay. Jericho needed to beat them in one night to get the credibility as champion.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's spend 3 months completely humiliating him so that when we get to WrestleMania, Hunter's point could be proven exactly right. You see, he wasn't a tough guy.
Yeah, it was all about his dog.
Rock and Hogan stole the show that night anyway.
Yeah. It's just funny. It was Tom Pritchard had said to me that you get to a certain point where, you know, you don't hear every single conspiracy theory, but it doesn't take much to kind of look at the shows and see it playing out. And I think that's been a problem for a while, too, is that you can almost see the politics starting to play out on screen now, as opposed to before where, you know, you would get a newsletter and you'd read, okay, Bret Hart did this to this one or something like that back in the day. Nowadays, you know, you could watch, and if you didn't know anything about backstage politics, I don't think it would take too much of a jump in logic to figure out that Triple H is connected somehow, you know, to the people who are putting the shows together.
And again, I mean, you used to bet on Monday nights if you did want to see, you know, a good political television show, you would turn on Nitro.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So just reeked of politics with all of Hogan's buddies getting spots at the NWO and Hogan having to have all the top time and all the, you know, wrestle all the top-tier guys. Yeah, you're right. And again, everyone has their favorites. Everyone finds their own way. You know, certain writers will latch on to a character and find a way to really thrust that character into the forefront, or at least really fight for that character, not so much for the good of the show, but for their own personal gain.
Yeah.
And the same is said with, you know, Johnny Ace hiring, you know, all these big guys.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, because that's what Vince wants. Well, let's bring up so-and-so from OVW. Why? Well, that's because that's what the writers want. It's not, and he does it to make himself look good. Instead of going and having the tough discussion with them, no, they're not ready, or no, why are you going to put that horrible gimmick on them? You're going to ruin them. And then they will draw us no money. And again, but there's no, since there's very little dollar investment, when you talk about a $1 billion corporation, you know, there's very little dollar investment at $750 a week. So it's easy to just cut a guy that, you know, isn't over, wasn't going to get over. I mean, there's a whole lost generation of guys that came up over the last 2 or 3 years, and you could put Brock Lesnar in that category as sort of the head of the class, because now he's got nowhere to go. And his is more of a political, legal fight, but Charlie Haas, Matt Morgan, Shelton Benjamin, you know, the list goes on and on. All those guys that came up during that era, they got fired. Maven, they got fired. They went out on the independents. They weren't worth the diddly squat because they were never over on TV.
Yeah, well, I mean, Benjamin's still there, but, I mean, obviously, I know exactly.
Yeah, but, I mean, he's in that class of guys that's a fantastic athlete, but isn't over at all, and if he got fired tomorrow, he wouldn't be worth $500 a night on the indies.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And it's almost like, I mean, the thing is promotion, and that's what always got me, is it's a wrestling promotion. So it's the wrestler's job to wrestle. It's the company's job to promote. And it almost seems like that's always the problem, is that it's a lack of promotion. Bobby Lashley, who was soaring to the top by Survivor Series, and now, for whatever reason, has totally cooled off for 3 months, and now they're doing the push again. And it's almost like, if you're going to get behind somebody, stay behind them and ride the momentum until it stops working, like Test, you know, and Test and Stephanie situation, you know, push somebody until the fans stop noticing. But it always came down to this whole Vince wants to cut their legs out early so that they get humble and then he can give them, you know, some sort of whatever. But by that time, as you mentioned before, it's almost too late.
Yeah, and right. Once you know, you only get that one chance to make a first impression, and if it's not a good one, you can forget it. And everybody that's gone on television and had their legs cut out from under them, I mean, Jillian Hall is a perfect example. It's a beautiful girl who, you know, they put a horrible growth on her face. Why? So that people will pay attention to her more than the other pretty girls on there? No. I mean, making people ugly doesn't make them marketable. And it seems like they've gone out of their way to create characters that are intentionally not marketable.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that. Is there such an embarrassment, a wealth of riches that they don't feel the need to create?
Yeah.
I really don't know.
Well, I mean, even TNA, I mean, I brought this up last week. TNA, one of their worst gimmicks ever were the Johnsons. which were a tag team based on being penises. That was the whole gimmick. And what does WWE do? Years later, after everybody mocks this gimmick from years ago, they introduce Chad and whatever Dick, Chad and James Dick, to come be the dicks on SmackDown. I mean, do they expect people to buy t-shirts that say, you know, I like dicks? I mean, what does it come down to?
I would have never hired those guys. Because they're midgets. I mean, I don't care how good anybody can wrestle. They're 5'6". Unless they're a really over-the-top character like a Taz, or just such a fantastic technician who just blasts away at people like a Chris Benoit, you know, it's difficult for guys that size to be larger than life.
Yeah.
And, Chad, I've known him a long time from the New England Indies, you know. There was just nothing special. He was a lifeguard. And he was just, yeah, okay, he's a lifeguard. I get it. He's a good-looking guy. He's got a good physique. But that's pretty much where it began and ended, you know, and he wasn't exactly lighting it up in the Indies, and then he got a dark match, Vince saw him, fell in love with him, and, you know, he was hired. But then what do they wind up doing? They wind up finding a way to create some stupid gimmick. And they're all, you know, the writers, to me, they're like court jesters. They just find a way to pop Vince, to make him laugh, to help get themselves over, and they create stupid gimmicks and with no regard to the long-term effects of the product or the characters themselves. I mean, do they even care about the people that they write for? You know, that list of guys that want to hang themselves from the Titantron, I'm sure there's a list of guys that before they hang themselves, they'd like to take out a group of writers and creative people with, an AK-47.
Absolutely.
Because the hatred and disgust and the contempt that those writers show for the people that are putting their bodies on the line. I mean, that's why a wrestling booker always needed to be somebody from the wrestling business, because deep down he needed to know what those guys were putting themselves through on a nightly basis. That's why I knew I could never be a booker in that old school mentality, because I was never in the ring. I mean, I was an announcer, and an announcer is somebody who can describe and feel, you know, help the audience feel the emotion, but never having really been in there myself, I don't know what it's like, it would be insulting of me, you know, to say, okay, you guys get in there and do that. Whenever I've helped lay out matches, on the indies, it's always, listen, you guys do whatever you feel comfortable. This is the story that we've come up with, and this is what we want to do. We'd like to accomplish this and this. You guys feel the best way to make that happen. Try to, again, always less is more. Be safe. Don't do anything crazy. And, let's find a way to get to tell a good story without anybody getting hurt. And then we come back, everybody come back through the curtain. First question would be, is everybody all right? You know, everybody okay? All right, good. Ooh, man, that was great. Thank you very much. And shake all their hands and pat them on the back. And then, hey, if things didn't go, if you saw something, because, again, my eyes were trained by Cornette and Michael Hayes and Dr. Tom and Jerry Briscoe and Pat and even Vince, and from the boys themselves, picking out things. And this is what I remember hearing, and this is what they're looking for up at the East. So, maybe try this instead of that, because this is what I hear they like. I always made sure I paid a real strong attention and asked a lot of questions of those agents and those great minds, so that I knew that, I could say, hey, listen, it's not me telling you, it's Jim Cornette telling you. No, it's Pat Patterson telling you. This is what they look for. Michael Hayes, tag team matches, Dr. Tom. This is what they try to do. This is what, I always use Regal as an example, because I picked his brain, ad nauseum, and found ways to pass along their knowledge to the young guys on the indie scene, because they're never going to have or might have very little time ever to be instructed by those people.
Yeah. Well, man, you're bringing up, like, knowing the business and knowing the performers before writing anything for it. It's funny that you bring that up. I was just watching A&E replayed the Unreal Story of Professional Wrestling from the late 90s, and it was splashed all over the place of Vince McMahon saying, they don't do good guys and bad guys. It's insulting. There are no good guys and bad guys. Everybody is themselves with the volume turned up. That was always a big thing in the late 90s. Austin was Steve Austin with the volume turned up. The Rock was, himself with the volume turned up. And now you look at the product, and it's almost like everything that they said in that documentary from that time period, which was one of their most successful things, they've done the exact opposite. I mean, is the boogeyman really him with his volume turned up? Is that what he's like? You know, I mean, they're all playing characters as opposed to doing what everybody universally agreed was successful about the late 90s.
And, again, even if you look at OVW now, mm-hmm. I haven't seen the TV show in a long time, but I read the recaps, and it seems like about two-thirds of the show is taken up with different characters. Now, I'm not sure whether or not those guys are being instructed by Stanford to, you know, do this gimmick, try to get it over, see how it plays on TV. Like, they took Jimmy Snuka Jr. Mm-hmm. and another guy and made them, I don't know, Andrew Dice Clay and somebody else from the 50s, and put Kara Slice on roller skates like she's a car hop at a drive-in. Mm-hmm. Where is it coming from? Where does it come from? Does it come from the top down? It can't come from the boys themselves because they're all afraid of their jobs. I don't think anybody ever suggests anything anymore. And that's a big problem as well, James. I mean, it used to be that the guys themselves were a tremendous wealth of creativity because they know their characters better than anybody. They know themselves better than anybody. They knew who they want to work with better than anybody. And I don't know if a lot of that gets spoken up anymore because they're all afraid of losing their jobs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's even funny you bring up OVW. They just did a show recently where Ken Doan and all them, they all went to WWE and became the Spirit Squad, which is just ridiculous on so many levels. You're bringing in a group of guys all at once. You're not giving any of them time to introduce themselves to the crowd. It's almost like the Natural Born Thrillers all over again, only they have a fruity gimmick on top of being, you know, a group with no backstory. They did a skit in OVW where they're now the Spirit Squad as opposed to the characters they were before, and stands out like such a sore thumb to the point where the angle is almost that their gimmick is ridiculous. And this is the angle that they're playing out before they even make the jump to WWE. What kind of self-defeating stuff is that? That you're actually going into a character's debut knowing that their gimmicks are ridiculous.
It's been, you know, and the problem with that I know Cornette toiled with when he was writing the TV was he would create something, and then they would say, we want so-and-so. They would take them. You know, the Bashams, for a great example. Doug and Danny Basham, you know, in OVW, were Doug Basham and the Damager, and they hated each other's guts, and they wanted to kill each other on a weekly basis on OVW TV. And then they had to find a way to put them together as a team. Not only that, but have them be brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Cornette had to come up with it. He came up with a creative, and I always told him it was his proudest thing. In my eyes, that was his finest moment. Coming up with a storyline that Basham forced the Damager to be his brother. And it was really against his will that he had to do this. And in the eyes of the OVW fans, it kind of got over. Matt Morgan was another example. We want to see him in a hood, Jim. Okay, we'll put him in a hood. Came up with a way. If I lose this match, I'll never show my face in this town again. So then, of course, he loses the match, and then he comes back the next week as the Blueprint. He's under a hood.
Mm-hmm.
Then after several weeks of this, we don't want to see him in the hood anymore. Oh, Jesus. Now I got to get him out of the hood after I do all this work to get him in it? Okay. So he's out of the hood now. Then it was, you know, we're going to bring him up with a stutter. Why? And then they bring him up with a stutter, and then they wind up letting him go. The guy's not getting over, Vince. We got to let him go. Well, of course he's not getting over because the gimmick was stupid.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I wish they held the writers and the creative staff with the same accountability that they expect of the wrestlers.
That's actually a good statement. I mean, I agree with you a lot on that. It seems like they release people under the rationale, we have nothing for you, but they keep taking a lot of these green guys, the John Heidenreichs of the world, and they give them 11 different gimmicks, none of which are anything, just ridiculous gimmicks on top of the next one. Let me ask you this, because you brought up a lot about doing the announcing and not feeling comfortable doing the booker, but you were an announcer on Raw for a while. Part of that, I think it was a three-man team. You were there with Michael Cole and JR, right?
Oh, yeah, those are good times.
Oh, yeah, I remember, actually, Russo did a whole article on that. I remember when, in the magazine.
That's right, the happy year in Todd Jr.
Yeah, exactly. I always remember that, because there was that graphic of the three of you that somebody drew, and you had, like, I think you had a button on it said heat machine or something like that. Or,
right, yeah, because I was always getting in trouble for something.
That was a crack-up, man. How hard is it to be an announcer? Because that's something that everybody talks about, you know, you got Vince in your ear, you have people telling you 11 different things and trying to mold you into whatever. What was that like for you being on Raw and dealing with the headset and hearing instructions being given to you?
It's very, very difficult. Being a wrestling announcer is very easy. Once you understand what your job is.
Mm-hmm.
Your job as a wrestling announcer is to get the match over and to hope to entice the people to buy more tickets or to buy DVDs, to sell the characters, get them over,
Yeah. Get
the story over, whatever it is. Find out what that story is beforehand and lay it out in the context of the grand scheme of things. You know, you don't want to belabor one point too much because of where we're going down the road. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Now take that with needing to have your thoughts in order and needing to get the characters over and be told what to say, which sometimes would be completely against what you went in thinking.
Okay.
So you have your mindset to do one thing, and then 180 degrees on the other side of the coin, you're being screamed at to do the opposite. Say it now, say it now. It's really tough. And, you know, Cole and Taz and JR and Joey Styles and King and Coach and all those guys, you know, it is a brutally, brutally hard job. And that's one of the things I think why Joey is... I haven't heard him struggle, but I guess apparently he is struggling. He sounds fine to me. He sounds like, you know, the same old Joey Styles, which, you know, is always a fine announcer. But I guess he's, you know, struggling with wanting to be what they want him to be. Well, you almost have to shut your brain off and don't think as a wrestling announcer when you work there. Because if you think, you're going to get into trouble because you're thinking logically, and while everything else that they throw at you completely spits in the face of logic.
Mm-hmm. Well, what really doesn't get me about Joey Styles, you brought him up, Joey Styles is now in this position where he's supposed to be the straight man for the three-man team, although Coachman kind of, him and Lawler veer in and out of babyface and heel every week. They go back and forth tweening. But they have Joey Styles, who has this kind of unique voice to him, and you can almost tell that they're feeding him lines that would kind of be more appropriate coming out of Jim Ross's mouth, you know, than his own. What are your feelings on the whole Jim Ross replacement and about, now here we are, we're a few months removed from all that now, that was like October, so like 4 months removed from Jim Ross leaving the Raw announce team. What do you think? Has there been any change at all?
Well, it's tough when you're used to producing for one announcer. I know I always did well when I worked with certain producers back at the studio. I worked with some producers better than others because some fed you good information, some laid out a lot, didn't say anything. Some would prep you before the segment, you'd go into it, give you just enough food for thought. Occasionally some would, you know, throw things in that you really didn't need and it would distract you, but you had the ability to stop, go back and say, hey, you know, what if we did it this way? And that was always walking a fine line because I always spoke my mind and always got into trouble for it because I was being difficult to deal with because I had a certain, again, I needed to shut my brain off and not think logically, not think like a wrestling announcer and just think like, you know, the robot that they wanted me to be. Joey's in a tough spot. Unenviable position to follow JR. Cole was in that same tough spot a few years ago. Wasn't equipped, wasn't ready for it. And was criticized for it. The only reason why Joey hasn't been savaged on the internet is because he's the darling of the internet. And really that was Vince's only way to sort of save face in the whole debacle that was the whole Jim Ross firing angle, where it was just handled so brutally bad. It was just an intentional, spiteful, mean-spirited attack on a man who had given his, you know, heart and soul and everything else to the business for, you know, 30 years.
Exactly.
And had been the bad cop for Vince on a number of occasions. You know, because the pressure that he had as a Raw announcer was a night off compared to what he had to deal with as the Vice President of Talent Relations. because that was the heat chair.
Yeah.
That's the chair that Laurinaitis loves, because he loves being the bad guy.
Yeah, that's... that has always been...
I know Tom has talked about a lot. Some guys love that, that they love to be the bad guy.
Oh, yeah.
They love to brag that they just fired somebody. You know, guess what I did today? I fired the Hefners. Mm. You know, I mean, that's a direct quote from Sonny H.
Oh, yeah. one of the worst things I remember about the Hefner things, people come out now and it's always a thing on the internet. We always like to play devil's advocate to everything. So, I mean, obviously there's other sides to every story. So, I mean, Hefner's, you know, there's things behind everything. But what really got me about their story was that Dave had called, and he said this on the Radio Free Insanity when we first started it, Dave had called for his severance package, and the exact words he was told was, Johnny said you don't deserve a severance package. And it just blew my mind because, I mean, whatever he did, he didn't kill anybody backstage. This is a guy that worked there, and his brother screwed Brett, and I mean, Christ, what do you... To get treated like that on the way out, even if you did something wrong, it just amazed me, you know?
Again, I think for all of the critics of Vince, one thing that Vince said about Shawn Michaels when Shawn was home, because again they were looking at payroll, because again at that point, 97, 98, 98 really, I mean the company was starting to come out of it, but they were looking for ways to cut payroll,
mm-hmm.
because it was... money was starting to come in, but it wasn't at that level yet. Well, I guess Sean at the time was, I don't know, getting 15 grand a week. And Vince said, I'd pay him the 15 grand a week to sit home just as a thank you for all that he did for us.
Yeah.
I heard him say those words. You take him out of the equation. Now, Vince was always very generous with money. You know, and Mark Merrow was a prime example of that. He personally signed Merrow and Sable to a big money contract, which left Taker and Brett and a lot of guys that had been working hard for less money going, you just signed who for what?
Johnny, you bet.
He sucks.
Yeah, totally.
He's horrible, and he's getting paid more than me. Oh, we're going to have to talk. Well, it wasn't JR doing the signing. It was, you know, it was Vince.
Uh-huh.
So Vince, you know, has a heart, or had a heart. I don't know if he still does anymore. I know it because I saw it. I saw the way he treated. I was there in Knoxville. We were all on TV at Raw, and Kurt Hennig had gone to see Mr. Fuji during the day.
Okay.
And I guess he was in bad health or was in bad financial straits. And Kurt went to TV and talked to Hefner, and Hefner went and talked to Vince. And Vince told Dave and Kurt, you know, they got some money together, whatever, out of the briefcase, and Hefner gave them 10 grand. But that came direct from Vince. You know, there are lots of stories like that where, you know, Vince's charity for the older generation came through. I don't know if he will do those things going forward down the road for, you know, the next generation of guys, but, I mean, he has a heart, or at least had one.
I mean, do you think that, here's the thing, that, I mean, it's going to sound so pessimistic and so cynical on my part, but Bret Hart now is going into the WWE Hall of Fame. I'm not begrudging Bret that. I think that the guy should go into the Hall of Fame. It's a company he worked for years, and that's great. The thing with the Hall of Fame that gets me is that these legends kind of have no option anymore. It's either you go, you eat from Vince's table one last time, or you're almost... kind of scared that you'd be white from history. You know, you're talking Billy Graham going back on everything he said on Donahue. You're talking, you know, all these things. Do you think that it's that sense of power now that Vince kind of holds all the wrestling footage, wrestling history is in his hands now for real, you know, as opposed to before where he would just pretend that wrestlers never existed when they left. Now he legitimately controls history. Do you think that's affected his outlook on the business and how he treats people?
I think there is a definite fear that everyone will be the next subject of the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the self-destruction of Bret Hart, I'm sure, was a title that flashed through Vince's mind more than once.
You know what? It was actually, because I knew somebody that was working on it, it was called Screwed. It was Screwed, the Bret Hart story, and they were putting it together to get to him.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I think that you could take any story and tell it any way that you want, especially if you have all the footage, all the cards on the table, and it's all you. You know, what's the big deal about going into a worked Hall of Fame anyway?
Yeah.
Your guys all getting bent out of shape about it. It's not like they're getting voted into Cooperstown or Canton based upon performances in a real sport. For God's sakes, professional wrestling is fake, fixed. It always has been and always will be. Guys that are good because they drew money. Guys that are good that drew money, whether they go into some stupid worked Hall of Fame or not, it has more to do with their own ego and believing their own character and living their own gimmick than anything else.
Yeah. They have. I mean, in this business, it's kind of like your glory is hung on the wall, as they say. Like, it's your past, and it's what you made of it. It's not necessarily whether or not Vince McMahon wants to acknowledge you.
It you know, again, I'm never going to be voted into any Halls of Fame. Although I am in the ECWA Hall of Fame. I will strike that. But I will not be voted into the WWE Hall of Fame. I don't deserve to be, based on their criteria. However,
James Dudley's in it.
Come up to me, when people come up to me and say, hey, Kevin, I remember you from TV. You always made me laugh. Stuff you did with The Rock was great. That means a lot. And that's really, you know, the Hall of Fame is in your own mind. Your impact on the business and what you meant and what you left, you know, how you made people around you better, that's all in your own mind. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you get a plaque and a handshake on a stage somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's almost, I mean, now we're really legitimately at the point where these DVDs are coming out, and you brought that up about the Ultimate Warrior, and that's what really got me about the Warrior DVD. It was this well-calculated way. Again, everything I say sounds so cynical, but really when you think about it, it's how it came out. WWE managed to make it so that they can get all these former stars back to make DVDs that they're making massive amounts of money off of. And kind of how do they do that? Well, they can use their footage for whatever they want, and if they want, they'll make an Ultimate Warrior DVD for you. So who do they pick as the first subject of the slam piece? A guy that has no defenders in the industry. And everybody kind of sat around and said, oh, ha, 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 the Ultimate Warrior, and all you know, Bobby Heenan went, and he buried him in the interview process and all these things. And everyone laughed because no one was friends with the Warrior, but no one stopped to think, wait a minute, they're not making this to really so much come down on the Warrior, but to kind of set a precedent. And now from this point on, we work with them, or you find yourself screwed, as they say.
Sure, and that's the whole thing. I never, you know, people have asked me, well, did you watch the DVD about the Ultimate Warrior, and what did you think? And I said, absolutely not. I would never watch it, because I don't want to support any project that tears down the legacy of someone that people like.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the boys in the back hated him or not, you can't argue the fact that for a short period of time, he was the most popular guy in professional wrestling. He and Hulk Hogan were it.
Absolutely.
You know, so for all those people who paid money to see him, what, their opinion didn't matter, their dollars didn't matter, and now we're going to take somebody that we don't like and we're going to, you know, that's juvenile. I refuse to give credence to any of that. You know, Ole Anderson is as bitter as they come, apparently. I've never met Ole, but I love his book, and I recommend it everywhere I go.
Okay.
Because it's a fantastic read. It's called Inside Out, How Corporate America Destroyed Professional Wrestling. I read the book 5 or 6 times because it's fascinating. I love it.
Yeah, there aren't 3 people who I think would say nice things about Ole Anderson. Not even Ole. But he doesn't deserve to be brutalized. He doesn't deserve a negative piece to be written about him. Neither does Warrior. Neither does anybody. But you're right. You know, how does the Bobby Heenan prevent it? I'm not saying they would ever do this to Heenan because he's loved, but How do you prevent having a negative DVD made about you? You make sure you come out against somebody that everybody hates. You're exactly right.
Exactly. That's the first one that they went to. And you see, I watched it, and one of the things about it just amazed the hell out of me. Hulk Hogan came out. He did a speech, one of my favorite lines in this DVD, and they put this on as if it was legitimate, as if, you know, everybody kind of, oh, ha, ha, ha. Hogan tried to bury the Warrior for their feud in WCW, and what he tried to bury him for was that he had brought up the fact that he beat Hogan in 1990, and Hogan actually says on the DVD that I think one of the cardinal rules of wrestling is you don't do that, or you don't mention beating him or something like that, and it was a total falsehood, and they kind of put it on there, but given that they were burying somebody in that context, it was all right, and it was the kind of thing that just amazed me, because Hogan, if anybody should know about what it's like to not be in the company and have the huckster and the Nacho Man jumping around with Scheme Gene, you know, making fun of him. Blows my mind. It kind of seems like these people get in Vince's good graces and they forget what it's like to not be in it.
People said when they fired Jim Ross, I remember reading somewhere that for all the negativity and how could you treat JR like this, that, you know, there probably isn't, you know, probably 99% of the people in America would sign today to be in that spot. Mm-hmm. You know, to take over for Jim Ross, to basically sell their soul, to work for a guy that you come out and say you hate. I mean, and Joey Styles did that. I don't begrudge him that, because it's about making money. It's about caring for your family, living your dream. If they call, and I had this discussion with my wife, I said, if they called, you know, or she asked me, if they called you, not that they would, but if they called you, would you go back? And I said, no, absolutely not. She said, what if they offered you $250,000 a year, 5 years, guaranteed, no cut? Nope, I wouldn't do it. And I wouldn't do it because I wouldn't want to put my family through the pain and the anguish that supersedes any of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's an agonizing place to work, especially now. And it was only getting bad when they let me go, and it's worse now. So I could just imagine how miserable it must be. I wouldn't put myself or my family through that for any amount of money.
I tell you, man, one of the things that gets me about you, Kev, and all the interview recaps I've read with you through the years, you've always been one of the more honest guys after leave, kind of stating your case. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that you are a fan of the industry. What do you think, as far as when you were there, the people who